warned Joe Gortner. When you coming back, Red Rider?
All right, friend, let's cut it. We need to have money to get to where we're going.
No, please.
I want to see you ride the range. All right, go on. A slack lever, you're Red Rider. Sound the packs.
What the hell's the matter with you, man?
You get out there behind that counter when I come riding in off the range, you say...
Red, honey, welcome home.
He steals their secrets. He strips their souls.
Arisham, you're making fools out of all of us!
You...
Let me handle it!
I'm in trouble and I don't trust you anymore!
What would you do if it happened to you? Marjo Gortner, Hal Linden, Peter Firth, Lee Grant, Pat Hingle, Stephanie Farrisee, Candy Clark. When you coming back, Red Rider. Rated R.
From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. With us this week, we have Stuart Balk in Stryak. Can't say hello, Stu.
This week it's Red Rider, actually.
Oh, right. That's right. And in the Rocky
Mountain
High,
Colorado. Don't call me Stewie. My name's Red Rider.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. I forgot. You were red-haired as a child.
That's why I was frequently beaten as well.
Well, you know. Yeah. You people have no souls. That's why.
No.
Anyway.
No, we don't.
And in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado, we have bass John Gray. Say hello, John.
Yeah, hello, everybody.
And just a reminder, everybody, when you go to MidnightMovieCowboys.com, please go to the PayPal and donate if you can afford to do so, or go to iTunes if you can't afford to do that, and leave us a rating and review. We really appreciate it. Thank you. So, Stuart, this week's episode is one that you've been wanting to do for a long time. So why don't you
pretty
tell
much
us
since the start, yeah.
Yeah. This is a movie I'd never even heard of till you brought it up, so.
I didn't think
so. Why don't you give us a little background?
Okay, so I'm going to just hear me out. I'm going to rattle on for a couple of minutes, but it is all relevant. Back in 1983, I was on a school excursion, and I was with a few friends, and we ducked into a video store at the time. And on the counter there was a catalog by a video company, very popular one over here, known as Roadshow Home Video. Now, on the front of the catalog was the new release at the time of First Blood. It had just come out in VHS, so that tells you how long ago this thing was. Anyway, flipping through the book, which my brother, if he's listening to this, will remember very, very vividly, one of the titles in the book, they had in there stuff like Wacko and A Force of One and The Octagon and a whole bunch of other stuff. But one of them in there was one called When You Coming Back, Red Rider. And it had the front cover of it was the poster for the film, which is what Roadshow always did, pretty much was always the poster as the artwork. But on the front of the actual thing, it said, the tagline was More Savage Than Midnight Express. And I thought, oh, sounds really good. I'd never seen Midnight Express at the time, nor heard of it. But it was more savage than, it sounded like it was something that was really, you know, bloodthirsty and whatnot. And it was rated R. Now, rated R was like the top of the ratings, as in like the nasties, like a video nasty, if you will. Anyway, time goes by, and this thing becomes harder and harder to find on VHS until about 1996, I want to say, I finally found When You're Coming Back, Red Rider on VHS tape to rent at this store about 20 minutes away from my house. Rented it, was really eager to watch it, and watched it, and was not what I thought it was going to be, because by that time I'd seen Midnight Express, but really enjoyed it. I thought the performances in it were just absolutely outstanding by all involved, and became really fascinated with the film. And as time wore on, VHS tapes obviously started to disappear. This thing was not on DVD anywhere. It still isn't, except for in Australia. Umbrella released it about 2 years back. But that was just a full frame effort, and you know, just above sort of VHS quality. So, but hey, it's available at least. So that's how I became to become familiar with this film. And it was like a real hidden gem that nobody knew of.
Yeah, I mean, when you kept bringing it up, because anytime Criterion would announce anything, you'd be like, fuck them until they release When You Coming Back, Red Rider, they can all kiss my ass.
Yeah.
But so I was always interested to see it because you were so passionate about it. And it stars a guy named Marjo Gortner.
Yes.
So what this is a guy, when I look into him, he sounds fascinating. He's a great actor.
Great actor. Great actor. Those, if you watch the documentary Marjo, boy, I don't know where you're going to get it. It has been released on DVD in the US about a decade ago. And I don't know if it's still available on iTunes. I bought it off of iTunes. I had it previously via a guy who has to trade tapes with in Canada who managed to get it for me. I was like, oh, wow, this is like a real holy grail tape that I wanted to see, and watched it, and I was really enamored with Marjo as a person. I'd seen him before in things like Food of the Gods, and there was a couple of others as well that escaped me. But I watched a documentary of Marjo, which I do want to cover one day because I think it's very fascinating, and he blows the whistle on the whole preacher thing. He was a child preacher at the age of 4 or 5, ordained as a minister.
He was like Sam Kennison. Sam Kennison was a preacher at a young age in the Pentecostal church, like Marjo was.
Yeah, but Marjo was about 4 or 5.
He was younger. Yeah,
he had an album out. What was it called? Hell with a Lid Off, which I've got that album, which just shows how sad I am. and yeah, his documentary from 1972 blows the whistle on the whole thing of how it's all a scam and it's all about the money. And of course, there's a very famous shot of him preaching on the circuit, and he's very good at what he does. And the next scene shows him rolling about in the bed, just counting the money. And it's, he was persona non grata after that documentary came out, which did win the Academy Award for Best Documentary of 72. But that's what... So Marjo is a performer at heart, going back as a child. But yeah, he's a great actor. I get what you're saying. I think this is his best performance that I've seen of every film of his. You know, I think he was in one called Star Crash. I believe he's in that, but
he was in Star Crash. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I grew up with him as basically a TV villain of the week on different TV shows.
Oh, yeah, Kojak. I could see that.
Yeah, I only recently saw the Marcus Nelson Murders, the original Kojak movie, where he's the villain. But he would always be a villain on shows like The A-Team or The Fall Guy or Airwolf or whatever. Like, he was always, like, you know, this week's villain, Marjo Gortner.
Yeah,
and he usually played an evil preacher or a rich guy or whatever, and he was always wearing like a white suit. So that's how I grew up knowing Marjo Gortner.
Mm.
I didn't see Marjo the movie until about 6 years ago.
Yeah, but he's a very charismatic actor, and he's the perfect choice for Teddy in this film. I can't sort of envision anybody else playing him. There is, and I'll put in the show notes for this, there is a stage production. This was actually a stage play.
Yeah. It was by Mark Medoff, who wrote the script for the movie as well.
Yes. There is a stage production that is up on Vimeo. I'm sorry to the uploader, I can't remember your name, but I do have your video bookmarked, and I will put that in the show notes. It's the full thing. It's about 85 minutes, so it's about half an hour shorter than what the actual movie is. So I'm guessing a lot of the stuff in the bowling alley and all the exterior stuff, like out in the desert of Mexico, is not in there. It's just strictly the stuff in the diner.
Yeah.
But it's good. I mean, the guy who plays Teddy, who Marjo played, is good, but he ain't no Marjo. But, I mean, it's good for curiosity's sake, if you want to see another take on this production.
Well, this production was kind of like Marjo's personal project.
Yes.
He produced it.
He convinced Melvin Simon to pump some money into it, and pretty much, I mean, he produced and probably had a big role in supervising the film, as well as starring. I mean, it was meant to be an acting vehicle for him, and I think the movie flopped pretty badly the year it came out in America. So it was, which I can kind of see why it didn't do very well. It's probably too much of that type of thing for audiences back then.
Well, don't forget as well, at the time they had a sort of logjam of Vietnam movies. You had The Deer Hunter, you had Coming Home, and I don't know if there was another one in there sandwiched in there as well, and this one still got lost in the mix. And
yeah, and it wasn't liked by critics. Critics didn't care for the film at the time,
which is
strange. It was also Apocalypse Now.
Oh, of course, yes, that's the other one I'm thinking of. It just that little old movie that slipped my mind that not many people have seen, right?
Yeah.
Nobody's seen that one.
No.
Yeah, more people have seen The Odd Angry Shot, I think. But Mark Medoff also wrote Good Guys Wear Black.
Oh, really? So he did.
Yes, so I remember Norris saying that they got a playwright to write the screenplay, and it was Mark Medoff.
Is that why there's no high kicks in the movie?
Maybe needed Chuck Norris in the film in the Hal Linden role.
Yeah, to lay his obligatory one sidekick, and that's it.
Or spinning back fist.
One and the other. But so that's basically my take on how it came to be, my sort of fascination, turned obsession with this film. This is one of those films I just can watch over and over and over. Do I watch as much, say, Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park? No, which I watch at least 4 to 5 times a year.
Sad.
Yeah, I know. But when I do watch this one, I watch it very, very closely. I won't have any sort of distractions or anything in the background. I've got to sit and watch it properly, because I will find something new every time that I watch it. I've seen this, got to be at least a dozen times. At least that. Just sit back and wait for that home video release, which I'm sort of losing hope for. And I think, and I've said before, I may have said before in the past, that I think the problem with this is the music is what's killing
it. Yes, I figured that out right away.
Jack Nietzsche.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, probably that. And you've got Van Morrison in there, I believe it is. You've got the Doors.
The rights to the... Yeah, you've got...
Yeah, yeah, all the real music in there is Tammy Wynette and B.B. King and...
Yes. And
that makes a video release of a film that was a flop at the time and is just really a cult movie. It's just not profitable. They're lucky to sell 300 copies of those when they put them out.
It's one of those things where like Shout Factory would have to put it out or something. I don't know.
Right, and they even admit they took a bath on stuff that they paid big money for music rights and everything.
Like they're putting out Where the Buffalo Roam on Blu-ray, and everybody was going, is that going to be with all the original music? Because the DVD release sure don't have it, you know.
Oh, really? I've got it on DVD, but I've never watched it. I picked up for a fiver. Sat on the shelf.
The DVD copy I saw didn't have the music in it. It had, like, substitute music.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a double-edged sword.
Sucks rocks anyway, but...
Yeah, no, it's not good. It's,
it's a terrible film.
Well, it's a double-edged sword because the thing is, someone can pick up that film like myself and not even know that there's music cues missing from it, whereas somebody who is really attached to it will know straight away. Like, if they ever release this, I'll know if a song's missing.
And especially in a setting like the movie has, you can't remove a Tammy Wynette song. You know, it's so ingrained in that, like, kind of small town culture, like it will lose something if you don't have that.
Yeah, well, it gets an anachronism because of the B.B. King song didn't come out till like 2 years after where the film is set.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so which always seems to be a case these days, like the Sweet Home Alabama and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake, and the movie takes place 2 years before that song.
Before the song came out, yeah.
We're going to see Skinner, mate.
They don't think it through, these filmmakers. Like, yeah, let's go put on some Skinner. But yeah, you're not looking at like a guy like Richard Linklater will be meticulous, and no.
He's a music nerd, so.
That's right. And it works to his favor in the end, because people will say, yeah, that's authentic. That song was out by the time this film was set in, say, 76 with Dazed and Confused, right?
Right.
I believe it's 1976 that's set in. And all the music on there is set 76 or before.
He did his research.
Yeah, I think he even said, I need to know if this song was released before summer 76. If it was released after, it's no good to me. So that's somebody who pays attention to what he's doing. But Richard Linklater's a good filmmaker, he's a...
He knows his music,
Whereas you get some of these horror hacks like Marcus Nispel who just go, Skinner, I think it's from the 70s, that'll do. It'll set the tone, exactly. Yeah, let's get on Mamas and the Papas, California Dreamin'. It's like, but yeah, it makes no sense. Putting scumbag Papa John Phillips in there, just ruins the film for me anyway.
So what you're trying to tell me is you're a big fan of Chungking Express, Stu.
That's a good Asian restaurant in my house, actually. They do a, no, if you, they do if a good Yum Chow on Sundays.
If you've seen a Wong Kar Wai's Chungking Express, like half the soundtrack is Mamas and the Papas, California Treatment.
Jesus Christ, is it?
In fact, you will be sick of that song by the time the movie's over.
I'm sick of it long before. I'm even sick of Creek Alley. Even though it's got the lyric, everyone's getting FedEx at Mama Cass, so...
And I will say I do like that film, but...
You know. Yeah, okay. No worries. But so anyway, Hunter, this was your first time seeing it. Obviously, you'd never heard of it.
Nope.
John, had you ever heard of this before?
Yeah, I'd heard of it because I think Leonard Maltin had like a negative review.
Yeah, he had a 1.5 star. I'm like, you bastard.
Yeah, I was like, this is unpleasant, you know, with his suburbanite square view of movies. So, but I remember that.
This is unpleasant, yet I think Todd Browning's Freaks is a masterpiece. Piss off, Leonard Maltin.
Bomb!
But, okay, so anyways, what did you guys think of this? I'm very, very curious to know what your thoughts were.
I really enjoyed it. I didn't really know what to expect going into it.
Right.
And it's definitely like, when I found out it was based on a play, that made sense because it's very, you know, it has kind of a confined location for most of the film. And I thought Marjo Gortner was a revelation. Mm-hmm. You know, he was amazing as the villain character. Very, very, you know, it's a very showy performance.
Oh, but very I like
that. You know, I don't knock that stuff. I mean, he really.
It's very theatrical, is what it is.
Yeah, he dominates the screen when he's on camera, and you know, it seemed a little bit like critique of small town life, which is not. I'm sort of romantic about small town life, even though I grew up in Dallas, Texas. Whenever I spent time in small towns, they always seem like really nice communities. But I'm okay with that. You know, that's kind of a staple of 70s, 80s movies is hating small towns in the suburbs, whatever.
And it's common from playwrights.
Yeah, absolutely.
Most playwrights were like gay guys or socially ostracized.
Yeah, they're
intellectual types that left their small town and I'm going to get back at this town, man, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I thought the Red Ryder character was very interesting. As you know,
Peter Firth, the actor Peter Firth, who is actually British. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was a really he was kind of one of the more interesting characters in the movie because his performance is so quiet, but he's such a hateful person.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, he's so mean to this poor, you know, waitress. And
oh, she was great.
She was amazing.
And he played Angel in the movie.
She was wonderful.
Fantastic. Like I said, the performances in this are really, really good. You go from the sort of over-exerted, like, Marjo's to the very sort of benign, like, Hal Linden's and Lee Grant's in this. I think the performances are stunning in this movie.
And I felt so bad for Hal Linden's character because Marjo Gortner's character just goes out of his way to turn him into a cuck, you know?
Yeah. You know? He really does. But you can see as well, there's one love scene in the film which shows that marriage is pretty much done with. It's
Absolutely. Like, what was it? When his wife says, "I don't feel safe with you anymore." I mean, that's when it's over. You know,
yeah.
When Grant says, "I don't feel safe with you anymore." That's when a woman says that, your relationship is done.
Yeah. But I read somewhere a criticism of this film, or a critique of this film, I should say, a number of years back somewhere. I'm sorry, my memory slips me where it was. But they said that the character of Teddy wasn't so much a protagonist as he was someone who awakens people to what's around them.
No, he does feel that. I think that's very true. Keep going, sorry.
That's right. Yeah, that's basically that in a nutshell. He awakens Lee Grant to the fact that she's living this very bored, miserable life and there's more to it.
And he awakens
like some sort of sexual awakening for her, you know.
Well, and he awakens Red Ryder, you know, sort of because he's this sort of cynical, you know, guy who hates everything around him, and he kind of awakens his masculinity a little bit by pushing him to that edge and picking on the people around him.
So the whole thing was the critique of this was: is Teddy actually humiliating these people or getting them to wake up to themselves? which I thought was very interesting, as he was with Angel when he said to her, you know who's going to marry you? Nobody's going to marry you. Which was just a horrible thing to say.
Oh, yeah, he's so mean to that girl. He's like, you know.
Well, yeah, he's mean to her as well, but he also kisses her hand when she's giving him the food and, you know, complimenting her. So
when Teddy, Marjo's character, comes into the diner, he seems like just a really overenthusiastic slash obnoxious customer.
Yes.
Like, who's just kind of like, okay, this guy's loud and annoying, you know, and then it turns into something more violent and horrible, but...
It's like when he goes, for instance, when Angel first says to him, oh, how are you all doing? He goes, I'm fine. And she goes, how are you? She goes, I'm fine. He goes, that's good, I'm fine. And he kept sort of mimicking her, but she wasn't cottoning on. She wasn't catching on. He was actually mimicking her. And
right.
Yeah, I just, it's like I said, I've just watched this over and over. I just sort of study this character, which is not something I really do. I mean, I certainly don't study Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park. It's just the, yeah,
popcorn. Well, you should.
I really should. I should study that black...
When Ace's character...
black stuntman that Ace had, sort of...
The first transracial character in film.
Very much, you know.
Very much ahead of Rachel Dolezal and Sean King, and,
Was Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park a sort of red flag for the Black Lives Matter movement?
I think
having
it kind of...
A black stuntman in... Kiss makeup.
Yeah, I mean, it was the first movie to really push the transracial movement, which you know, is unfairly maligned by the press. You know,
we're talking some shit right now. No, but with Red Rider, the film Red Rider, I find more in it every single time. It's just, it's kind of like Chinese boxes. You take one box out, and there's another one there, and there's another one in there, and you know, you keep, you know, just unraveling all these boxes, or, you know, keep opening all these boxes until you find something in the middle. And I don't think I found it yet, but I mean, I know I like this film a lot. Actually love this film. There's not many films I love. I like, yes, think that they're good, yes, enjoyed, yes, you know, all that sort of stuff, but actually have a love for a film. There's not many, but this is one of them. For sure.
And Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park.
Very much. And Can't Stop the Music is another one.
Yes.
Yeah.
If it didn't have Blackie Lawless...
Maybe. I would never watch it again. No, it's not worth it.
Right.
Nothing like seeing Blackie Lawless on a chain for 10 seconds. Yeah, that made it. That was the tipping point for me. It wasn't the great soundtrack. It was just Blackie and. Anyway, yeah, Can't Stop the Music. Don't worry about that at the moment. yeah, John, what did you think of it?
It's interesting. It has all the makings of a cult movie. Like, from the over-the-top performance to, like, the kind of weird use of the Jack Nitzsche music, and that gives it a weird vibe that seems like a lot of other movies, like, in the 90s tried to kind of capture that a little bit. I wouldn't be surprised if Tarantino...
Oh, I'm sure.
I was thinking about
somehow.
It.
Yeah, yeah.
I was thinking about Tarantino when I was watching this. I was like, oh, that kind of chamber piece element, you know.
It does have a staginess to it that comes from being based on a play. And I imagine, like, I think Hal Linden's presence in the film probably hurt it at the box office, because back then you just couldn't have the TV star of a sitcom in, like, a theatrical film that was serious.
John,
it just was.
If you said
Hal Linden, you would think, oh, it's a Barney Miller movie. Like, right away, that's the way people.
Or Animals, Animals, Animals. Was that around at the time?
Right. Yeah, that was around. Like, yeah. So
that's where I knew from as a kid.
Right away.
Yeah.
It's like maybe they should have hidden his credit on the poster or something. Or I don't know what the TV ads were like. I don't remember this film being released. I just, you know, read about it in the Maltin book. So
yeah.
It obviously disappeared pretty quick. But yeah. You know, I like the movie. It's pretty interesting, and I think that people are into, like, just bizarre cult films that I can't always figure out why they have a following. You should probably check it out, and I think it might be more up their alley. And I honestly, if this got a good DVD release, I think it would be rediscovered. But those music rights, man, as soon as I heard, like, the Doors or Tammy Wynette, I was like, this is never released.
I knew. Like, when the DVD Blaze, you know, first came about, and around the, what, very late 90s, say, and by the time it really started gaining some traction in the early to mid 2000s, I was keeping an eye out for this thing. I said, "Nah, that music's killing it. I know for a fact." And no one's going to fork out big money for the Doors and BB King and all that. It's just, it's going to take me when that. It's going to be tough.
It was just like the heavy metal cartoon movie was held off of video forever for the same reason. And Fast Times at Ridgemont High, I'm not 100% on this, but what I heard, like, it's apparently they never released something that matched the theatrical version soundtrack on home video or even cape.
See,
they were constantly changing it, apparently.
I hate this whole music rights shit for home video re-releases. It just should be... There should be a clause, and they're saying, we've paid for the song. Any future home video releases will have permission to have this song. You're being paid enough for it, seriously.
And it promotes the song.
It really does.
It's like, it promotes the music. Like, why not be a little more lenient on that?
National Lampoon's Animal House is a classic example. Yes, I know you guys aren't very big fans of John Landis, but I really like that film.
I like Animal House. Oh, okay.
I've
never been able to sit through it.
Okay. Anyway, the major problem with that one is, and people go on the forums and say, okay, Animal House has just had a re-release now, first one that came out in high definition. Hey, is Sam Cooke's What a Wonderful World on there? Because that would be on there sometimes on some home video releases via the VHS or DVD later, and sometimes it'd be there, sometimes it was removed. And stuck him with generic 70s rock music, which absolutely did not make any sense. It didn't fit the time frame of 1962 or 63, whatever film set in. And it was just like a massive sore thumb sticking out.
Yeah, the version I have has it.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I've got the Blu-ray, and it does have the Sam Cooke song, thankfully. But there's that. I know Beverly Hills 90210, when it got a home video release, was... butchered with its music. And the big daddy of them all, WKRP in Cincinnati, home video release was slaughtered initially. When the second wave came out, I believe it was by Shout, I think it was.
Yeah.
They managed to get most, but not all the songs still. I think they couldn't get any Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin. I can't remember which band it was. It was one of those two.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And there's another one. There's an episode of WKRP in Cincinnati, which has the Russians coming to the station, and I can't remember what the storyline is, but the song that was used at the end was Elton John's Tiny Dancer, which made absolute sense when you watched the episode, because one of the Russians would say to one of the females, not Lonnie Anderson, the other one, and goes, and he would say, oh, hold me closer, Tiny Dancer. That's what he would say to her. And he said that at the end when they're dancing, and then the Elton John song was over the top. On syndicated episodes later on, it has just some mood music and it makes no sense.
Yeah, so, I seem to vaguely recall it. And it's funny because when I watched it in syndication a lot, it seemed to imply they were playing popular music, but I never heard it. You know?
Yeah.
It like suddenly it's like, okay, you're supposed to have a Who song here and it's not a Who song, you know, because the dialogue would indicate it.
Another show that had that problem was The Wonder Years.
Oh, yeah. God, yeah. I think they got all the music rights to that. That's why it was such a long delay getting it out.
Yeah, I think they finally did get it. I could be wrong, but yeah.
Now, there's
show
that would have been a labor of love to get all that music.
Oh, yeah, because the music was very integral to that show.
Well, that's why when that first came out on home video on DVD, The Wonder Years, it was only ever done through Time Life initially.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think the rights were reverted back to... I forgot who the TV company was, the production company was.
But we have to remember back when all this stuff was made, they never would have fathomed that.
No, exactly.
This stuff would be available on home video.
And that brings it back to Red Rider, where the problem was, oh, we like The Doors, so we're going to put People Are Strange in there. But they haven't thought about this home video nonsense later on.
And, you know, the music industry is an industry that's pretty much hurting right now, so they're not going to give up any opportunity to make money,
This is what I can't understand, all right? When a new release CD comes out, what is it over there, usually 10 to 12 bucks? Maybe a bit
more?
Yeah,
CD is like 10 bucks usually these days. Back when I was a kid, it was like $18.99,
yeah.
You know.
Over here, it's $26.99 usually, okay? So that's a lot. But the problem is with CDs, they never drop in price. They stay fixed.
Is that new or used? Or
no, this is always, if you're buying it new.
Okay.
If you're going to a store, it's always going to be like $9.99, or some of the rarer ones will be like $14.99. Whereas a Blu-ray, say of Doctor Strange, let's say, right? It's the first one that came to my head. Might be expensive now, give it 6 to 8 weeks. You'll pick it up for cheaper than what you can do with CD. And this is a movie that costs 150, 200 million bucks compared to a band producing something in the studio, which might have cost them 2 or 3 million at the most. So I've never understood the whole greedy aspect of the music industry, whether it be the price of their CDs or the music rights for television shows or movies. It's a weird ass industry.
Yeah. No, it is. Yeah.
And that's why CDs are dying. That's why they're a dead.
Well, they're dead.
Obviously, but he's getting all shit free. But never mind it.
The CDs. Can't play a vinyl in my car.
Yeah. Wouldn't buy CDs if I had to pay for them either. I get a lot of shit free. But yeah, so it's a weird industry, the music one, and it's just considering a band these days can pretty much crank out something on their iMac at home or even
I know, like budgets for albums are tiny now.
It's just
that's why they're dying. It's like you could do this in your house and there's enough home video home recording stuff that you can do on your computer, it sounds just as good as what you would get in a.
But their problem has been is they're trying to combat the piracy. But yeah. By keeping the prices high, you're not helping.
Yeah. I wondered how they were going to make it on how they price those damn things like 30 years ago. I remember there were class action lawsuits against the industry saying the CDs were too expensive.
They are too expensive. I mean,
I don't know if
they were
one or not, but they're ridiculously expensive.
Yeah, and that's why nobody's buying them. If you slash the price of those things to say $5.99, okay, you're losing say $4 initially when these things are released in say the first week of sale. But you might get 2 or 3 times more people buying them because they are such a low cost. They're basically a throwaway price.
Yeah, Walmart was trying to do that with the music industry. They were trying to demand every new CD be like $7.99 or $8.99.
Yeah.
And apparently that was a bit of a war with Sony and whatever other company makes music, or releases CDs.
Back over here, back in 1998, 99, I believe it was around there, the music industry over here tried parallel importing to combat the price of the expensive CDs, and they were getting this shit in from Indonesia.
Right.
But even then, they were like $14.99. It wasn't happening. It wasn't. Make them $10, and that's why I dare say CD stores, secondhand CD stores thrive so much compared to the ones that sell the new stuff. Because if I'm seeing something like the latest Darkness album, let's say, and it's going to be $24.99 here, I'm like, well, I'll jump into a secondhand store in 3 or 4 months' time and pick it up for about a third of the price,
right?
And that's more attractive to me at that price. Yes, the Darkness aren't getting the money. Sorry, Hannah, the Darkness aren't getting the money, but fuck, I've got a budget as well, like everybody else does.
Well, and, of course. And also, what's the cost of, download iTunes in Australia?
Usually an album will be $16.99.
Okay, wow. I mean, it's like $10 here.
Yeah, I know. But they'll go, with a dollar and all that. But no, that's just BS. It's all just a thing. I mean, like ticket prices back to the cinema. I'll be really quick on this. Remember how I told you I was sitting at $20 and now jumped up to $24. It's like, you idiots just don't get it. You're not going to make the money back doing that. You need to slash the prices. You need to trump this shit, man. Don't raise taxes. Cut the taxes. Don't raise the prices. Lower the friggin' prices. That's how you get people back in the door. I can't afford to take my family out to the movies. You know what it costs me?
It's insane in Australia.
Three adults here, and say the three boys, the youngest one's just too young to go to the movies. So six people, I'd be looking at, about $120. You know what my attitude is? I'll buy the Blu-ray for $20 when it comes out.
Yeah,
I'll wait 3 months, and I know I can pick it up at JB Hi-Fi first week of sale for $19.99. Oh wait, it's the attitude. I don't get it. And of course now with digital prints, they cost nothing.
Right.
So, yeah, it's just.
Yeah, it pisses me off. It's why I don't go to the movies that much, other than the movies suck. But I'd go see bad movies if it was just like $5.
But don't you have like dollar theaters or $2 theaters or something? We don't even have those.
You do have second run, but it's a couple of months later. And they don't get everything. You know, if something was a bomb in theater, sometimes they won't even bother to put it out. What's funny is in second run, something can be a hit that was not a hit first run. Like that movie Monster Truck, is actually doing very well at the second run Elvis cinema. It's run for weeks. Like when they debuted that Return of Xander Cage XXX movie with Vin Diesel, that premiered as split screened with another cartoon movie, like Trolls or something.
Oh, really?
So it's funny how the economics of the second run cinemas work.
Because people can afford it. That's their price. That's their sweet point for the pricing. $3 or $4. I can do that.
They still don't want to see the Vin Diesel movie.
No, I understand. But yeah, I mean, what's a normal ticket cost over there, say, for a. Say a Friday night session for a
film. Like a first run?
Yeah.
Your average theater, it's going to be between $9 and $11.
Yes, they're starting to creep up a bit.
And if you go to the Alamo, your ticket might be $9 or $10, but then you're going to have to buy food and you'll tip the waitress or waiter, and that's,
For what? They're just doing their job. They're there.
Yeah, because we have a tipping culture here.
Boy, don't I know that one. That's I love America, a fantastic country, but that tipping culture needs to fucking go.
The Alamo is based on, it's a service-based theater. It's different than other.
Yes.
Americans hate Australians with tourists because they're just such cheap bastard. They're so cheap like me. It's like, tipping, what's this? Why have you got your hand out?
I think I was always, tipping extra because I knew Stu wouldn't.
Kidding or not, I take no offense because I think I probably am not tipping. I mean, I don't know who to fucking tip over there. Do I tip, Hunter, for instance, that little Mexican place we went to where we had all those fantastic tacos? Would you tip there or not?
Probably not. You usually tip if you're getting waited on. Okay. If you're going up to if you're going up and ordering, you're allowed to tip. But it's not really expected. But if you go and sit down and someone's waiting on you, it's expected that you tip.
That's why the whole I don't tip thing from Reservoir Dogs is pretty much my mantra in life. When I first heard that, when I saw that film at the theater when it came out, I'm like, oh God, this typifies me to a T. This is me all over.
Society says tip these people over here, but not these people over here.
I tell you what, he's got it so fucking right when he says that. It's like, yeah, you can tip them, but what if you tip them? You don't tip them.
We're going to have a lot of angry waitstaff people commenting on this episode.
Well, I'm sorry, but...
Well, no, they should change it where they raise their pay, but tipping is not a mandatory thing or expected thing. It's like, because a lot of them are working for far under minimum wage. Restaurants are allowed this sort of thing where they can pay them something like $3 an hour.
And that's one reason they're allowed to. That's one reason they hire so many illegals, you know.
Because they'll work for that and they won't complain about it either.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And, I mean, when I worked at a restaurant, you know, you'd get your paycheck and it would be like $10 or whatever. Yeah. You know, but it would be tips is where you get your money. I don't know. There's a lot of debate over whether or not tipping should go away. I know a lot of people who work in restaurants and stuff who say no because, you know, they're being rewarded for the amount of work they do and blah, blah, blah. And I know a lot of people who say that tipping should go away. So I don't know. But I mean, you know,
the only risk you run there, sorry, is if you do a way of tipping and you give them, say, a much higher wage, the standard or the quality may drop. Like over here, people don't tip because waiters and waitresses get pretty good money. Like, they're on about $18 an hour at least, if not $20 an hour. But the quality and the standard is just dreadful for the most part because they're getting paid anyway. So
yeah, and I think one thing here is I think that's one thing because, you know, especially in Texas, like, restaurants are big business.
Oh, yeah.
And they are frequently fail, but they frequently succeed as well. And I think part of it is that they don't have to pay their workers out of their pockets that much, you know.
I still laugh every time I think about when you told me that on payday, illegals go around and get their checks cashed at some truck with a guy with a shotgun.
That's a construction site.
Oh, construction site.
Yeah, they have the mobile check cashing places. And I was sitting there going, you know, there's a guy just polishing a shotgun in the back of his
Oh, man, that's too funny. But yeah, so anyway, that was the ticket price that the theaters here have gone up and the whole CD thing. But yeah, that, yeah, Red Rider's main problem is the music. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm an idiot. I check Blu-ray.com every day to see if it's been announced, but my heart just sinks every morning. I just think, well, I give up. It's, you know, I'm only hoping some sort of crazy sort of notion of this episode coming out, we'll see some sort of, you know, release for it, because before in the past we have said, hey, it'd be nice if this came out, and sure enough, a few months or even a year later it's announced. So I'm not going to hold my breath on that.
Yeah, well, somebody needs to do a remastering of it, because...
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
All the prints out there, probably even the, I guess, the Umbrella DVD or whatever is said to exist, come from, appears to come from like a cable TV master.
I think the Umbrella one, Umbrella acquired the Roadshow catalog. There's a lot of movies that came out via Roadshow VHS back in the day that are now out via Umbrella, which is great. I mean, they're preserving this stuff, but I'm guessing the print they had was strictly the one they used for the VHS. Otherwise, if they had any sort of widescreen, they're a pretty good company. They'll put it out. If I got one complaint...
Yeah, it's probably from a quarter-inch master or something.
Most likely, yeah. If I got one complaint about the Umbrella release, and it's minor, but with me, it really is... like a chicken bone in the throat sort of thing, is that the poster for When You Come Back, Red Rider, had a silhouette, or like an image of Marjo's back turned to the camera sitting on a diner seat, and the rest of it, or the background, is in red. On the DVD, it's the same image, thankfully, but it's more of a hueish brown in the background, and I wish they just had to go on the red, that's all. But that's about my only complaint. Oh, that, and it's not in widescreen, but... Hey, I'll take a release of it over nothing at all.
Well, I don't think it was shot wide, so...
I think it was. Are you talking about scope wide or just like a flat?
I'm talking about like... yeah, because a lot of spec just wasn't shot like that. Yeah, 1.85 is the aspect ratio on IMDb, which tells me that you might actually be getting an unmatted image on the DVD where you get more top and bottom info.
But there's a lot of close-ups here that have sort of faces out of frame. So
yeah, I don't know if maybe that's the way it was filmed or something, because, well, I've noticed a lot of stuff. Like, you remember the William Friedkin movie Bug? Came out like 10 years ago.
I've never seen it.
I've only seen parts of it. I couldn't really get into it. But it was filmed like that as well.
I saw it.
And it was based on a play, and it's a lot of close-ups of faces.
It's by the same playwright that did Killer Joe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You see LEDs, yeah.
But I noticed there was a lot of tight framing in this, which led me to believe this is obviously shot flat at least. It wasn't filmed.
It's totally intentional, because stuff that's based on a play is usually completely focused on the actors' performances, facial expressions.
Yeah.
And that's the way those films are always made.
Yeah, I wish the director had a pull back a bit and just said, I don't need this tighter close up. Some scenes, yes. Obviously, when Red Rider's talking directly to Teddy and there's a close up, yeah, you need that. But some of the shots are, yeah.
Apparently, the director of this movie was a hardcore Scientologist.
Milton Katselis, yeah. That's what I read. I don't know much of his work, unfortunately, but.
I don't really know much either. I was looking at him and I was like, I don't really know much about this guy.
Yeah.
Like, not many movies he's done. I haven't heard of any of the movies he's done, to be honest, except for this one. Apparently he was a lifelong Scientologist, although I think he had a falling out with the church, but he was still friends with L. Ron when...
In spirit.
Throughout his life.
Yeah, he was in spirit.
Yeah, he and their Thetans were bros, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so overall, John, you thought it was an interesting piece.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like, this is a movie I'd have been more impressed by, like, maybe 25 years ago when I wasn't so overexposed to cult movies. Because that's something I realized with, like, the complete flood of DVD and the advantages of Netflix and even your local library getting Lucio Fulci movies on DVD, is I am just totally overexposed to that type of weird cult movie making.
Yeah.
You know, because it's just so easily accessible. I watch more of that in mainstream movies, and one of the reasons that these films have cult followings is because they were a break from mainstream movies that people were seeing.
But let's call it for what it is. The majority of the cult films out there are pretty much riddled with bad acting. Whereas this does not have bad acting in it at all.
Right. No, the acting's really good, but I think because it was a flop, it was used to write off Marjo as a screen talent.
Mm.
Like, I think because he was on his way up, but I think he was using a lot of his own money and influence to get these projects made, you know, to be the actor. And they kind of frown. Weirdly, the industry frowns on that.
I wonder,
and it just kind of ended him and made him a TV movie villain, basically.
I wonder if this was funded via his donations from the parishioners.
Could have been. But apparently it ended his screen career. You know, it flopped bad enough and the critics hated him. And I think he was really disliked at the time because people misunderstood where he was coming from, I think.
He was married to Candy Clark as well at the time of making this film.
Yes, he was, and she dubbed Caroline Munro's voice in Star Crash.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was like a secret for many years. Nobody knew who dubbed her, and it was Marjo Gortner just had his wife dub Caroline Munro's voice, which was a standard practice back in the day.
He had no problem throwing her out there with nudity, did he, in this film?
No, not at all. I guess, this movie was... I think it'll be interesting if I watch the stage play version to see the difference, because I do think this was his ego, you know, like, hey, look at my wife, you know.
Yeah.
It was his version, although with a lot more talent, of a Rob Zombie type of project, you know.
Yeah. Look at my wife, Red Ryder. You staring at her tits, boy.
Yeah, exactly. You know. Yeah.
I mean, if there is one thing in here that it kind of bugs me a little bit is the whole William McKinney. I mean, I don't really know what his purpose is in the film.
Yeah,
as the owner of the diner,
I thought that was Austin Harding or something.
The is that the Pat Hingle character, or no, the guy who shows up at the
Bill McKinney's like in it for like what is it, 2-3 scenes?
Yeah, he's the guy who shows up at the end.
Yeah, that's about his only reason why he's in the film is to show up.
He's just there to sort of move the plot along. Essentially.
I mean, I've also wondered how the hell that diner ever survived. It can't just live on Pat Hingle's money because it's he's only ever buying like a cup of coffee and maybe a bite. So you can't live on that. I think people need to watch this film, and I will track down a version of it to put in the links. I will try.
Yeah, it's definitely worth watching. I mean, I really enjoyed watching it. It's a good chamber piece, and you know. It definitely has your Clint Eastwood references if you're a fan of good old Clint. Which, if you listen to this show and you're not a Clint fan, what are you doing? You know.
Yeah.
Exactly. What's your problem? You should be listening to this show.
But I really enjoyed the performances. The whole Red Honey Welcome Home sequence is it's kind of soul destroying to watch because he's people being humiliated beyond words, and he's. Running around like he's a filmmaker with his, you know, his hand over his eye, like he's trying to get the shot that he wants, and he's clearly an unhinged character. Marjo's one is, but I can't speak highly enough of this film. I really can't. It's hard for me to put in words because it's so layered. This film is. I mean, you guys have seen it once. I've seen it a lot of times, and there is a lot more you'll find in it as you watch it. It's just a lot to take in the first time around.
And it's a New Mexico diner, right?
Yes.
Okay, I just changed the Wikipedia page. It said a Texas diner, so I changed it.
Oh, really? Okay, no, it is a New Mexico one. There you go.
New Mexico diner. Fucking Wikipedia, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's dreadful. There was an entry for Bruce Lee's Game of Death that was embarrassing. It was so bad.
It matched the movie itself.
It's worse than the movie. It was more incomprehensible than the goddamn movie.
Oh, boy, that's saying something. Now, he comes from Mexico. Marjo's character comes from Mexico through New Mexico, going to California. Does that sound right? My American geography is not great.
You could go to California. Yeah, that would work.
That would
work?
It's
a common route if you're going from Texas to California. You go through New Mexico.
You go through New Mexico, yeah.
Okay, then.
New Mexico's right next to Texas.
Oh, if you're going from Colorado to Los Angeles, you can go through New Mexico. Go down to New Mexico.
I'm gonna be driving through this summer.
Are you? Don't stop at a diner, for God's sake.
I know, right? I'm going to Montana. I'm gonna go see Little Bighorn, stuff like that.
You gonna catch up with Marie Osmond?
Yeah. Yeah.
John, do you get that reference about the song? Meet me in Montana.
No, I've never heard the song. I haven't listened to that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know it.
I need to see if we can stop in Denver and hang out with John. But
yeah, I I don't know if that's possible with that geography of yours, but it's...
we'll be driving through Colorado, that's for sure.
Who are you going with? Probably, your father?
You're probably going through Denver.
Mom and Dad.
Very good.
Yeah, they were like, we're going to Montana this summer. You want to go? And I was like, yep. They went last year. And they loved it so much. I was like, yeah, I'll go. And I think we're going to be driving through, so I'm going to see if I can convince them to make a stop.
If you do stop in New Mexico by any chance at a diner and you hear, action, boy! Just keep driving. Just get back.
Keep going.
We are going to be staying in Taos. I know that on the way back, I think. But I love Taos, New Mexico. I mean, it's a little new age shitty, but it's but I like it a lot.
I've been there. I like it. I like Santa Fe. Like, I like Santa Fe and Taos quite a bit.
Yeah, totally.
If I could retire there, I would.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Santa Fe. I really like Santa Fe.
You're going to grow your hair out and...
3 years from now, but yeah, I like Santa Fe quite a bit.
I think New Mexico is one of the most beautiful places in the country.
It is. Totally is.
Well, if I wasn't so put off by this movie of going to New Mexico, I'd actually go there for a visit. But
John Carpenter shot vampires there.
Oh, no, definitely not going.
but in his commentary, he was like, New Mexico is one of the most beautiful places in the country. And I was like, I agree with that. I mean, I can't tell from the movie, but I agree with that.
He's only going by what he's seen on a video game somewhere.
A lot of TV shows are filmed there. A lot of cable TV shows and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mexico is a popular filming spot. I think
they got
Breaking Bad is all shot.
Well, they got houses in New Mexico as well. Like they said in Bronx Warriors 2. We got houses for you in New Mexico.
Yeah. Well, I made a point that was hilarious because it would be great to move to New Mexico.
Yeah.
Like, I guess the Italians thought New Mexico was a bad place. No, it's
the only drawback, John, is when you get your house, you got a massive poster of trash in the hallway.
Yeah.
Like a life-size poster of trash in there. So if you can do all that, you'll be set.
Exactly.
A nod back to our Bronx Warriors episode from 1925 that we did.
Yeah, that was back in the Jazz Age. We
watched it on Nickelodeon.
Yeah, we did, yeah. Butler Saw Machine.
We went to the local Nickelodeon. We popped our quarters in and watched it. It was good.
Yeah.
Then I went and listened to my wax platter of Jelly Roll Morton. It was great.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think it was a shellac LP. So.
I think, didn't we do an episode when Jelly Roll died? We were very upset.
Yeah. We did a memorial. That was
it was in 1930 or something. And we also did an episode on the legend of 1900 to commemorate the passing of Jelly Roll, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
And review of, what's that movie called? Birth of a Nation, when it came out.
Yeah, that was our first episode.
Yeah, that's right, it was, Birth of a Nation.
We were talking about the coming of the feature film, yeah.
And, Hunter was really down on that, because he's, you know, hardcore Catholic convert, so.
I know, I was. Klan
hates Catholics, which a lot of liberals don't seem to realize.
It feels like it was that long ago since we started this damn thing. But, all right, look, I've got nothing else to talk about, which you think I would, but all I can say is please go watch this film.
Yeah, yeah, check it out. Find it any way you can, and let's give our ratings, Stu. What would you give it, since you're this was your baby, this show? What would you give it?
Come on, man. What do you reckon I'm going to give this?
I think you would give it 10 cucked violins out of 10.
Well, yeah. I haven't thought about what, but yeah, it's 10 deranged Vietnam vets out of 10.
Okay.
It's absolutely a 10 for me. Is it a perfect film? No. Is it interesting? Absolutely, and one that needs to be seen. I really wish, I'm putting a plea out here now, someone please release this. Okay, yeah, I know the music rights are going to be a bastard to do, but this film needs to be preserved at least some way.
Yes.
You know, it really needs to be preserved. I don't want it dying off a death. Like, I don't want this being the, what's that film called? The London After Midnight of the 70s. I don't want that
happening. Right, right.
It was like, we found a copy of Red Rider underneath a Argentinian freeway. I don't want that happening. I want someone to find a print, do some sort of cleanup on it, try and track down Marjo, who's now basically retired and doing golf tournaments every year, and try and track down Marjo. Stephanie Ferracci's still alive. Peter Firth is still alive. Track down Hal Linden.
Columbia Pictures put this out. They're sitting on a ton of stuff. Columbia is probably the worst in terms of having a huge vault of stuff they never put out on home video.
Look, this film's 38 years old. Yeah, it sounds a long time, but in terms of film, which has been around over 100 years, it's not that old. You know?
Yeah, but Columbia in their 70s catalog, they're the weirdest company about this. Because I would always look like, okay, some of the Terrence Hill Bud Spencer movies, like Watch Out, We're Mad, yeah. That was a Columbia release in America. You would never know because they never bothered to put it out on home video.
Well, yeah.
And even when two of the Hill Spencer comedies, they decided to dump on home video, they licensed them to Warner Brothers.
No, that's the thing. They just, there's like a real give a fuck factor over there, don't give a fuck factor, I should say. It's like, yeah, what's this film? We're just sitting on it. But somebody out there wants it. Yeah, okay, you can't put it out for one person, but there's a lot more who are going to buy it, probably more than what they think. I mean, even if you put this out, and I really hate saying this, even if you put this out via Twilight Time, which have Columbia's rights, and limit it to 3,000, you're going to make your money back on that. I won't advocate that, that's for damn sure. I wanted to get a mass release, at least be accessible to buy, not just the 3,000 people who are going to buy 10 copies each and stick the bastards on eBay later on. But if you need to just make a small amount to recoup some money and get this thing out there, then do it that way, at the least, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think I would give this movie 7 sliced off tattoos out of 10.
7 born dead tattoos.
I give it 6 anal probes at the Mexican American.
Oh my goodness! Yeah. You know what, Marjo? That's what you get for saying. And a considerable amount of cocaine. Just, yeah, you don't sort of say that at the border.
That's not something you do at the border. Sorry, dude.
Funny in the car when you're telling your wife or your girlfriend, whatever she's in the mill. Not funny telling the guy at the border that.
Nah.
Yeah. But I do want to blitz through this stage play. I've only watched a little bit. And like I said, I will put it up in the show notes for you guys to watch and at least get an idea of what you're in for. But it from what I look like, what I see, it's nowhere near as good as the film. I'm going to say it, though. I think the film's a masterpiece. It really is. It's an undiscovered masterpiece. It needs a goddamn release somewhere. Now I'm starting to get angry about it.
Well, there is a lengthy review of the film at Cool Ass Cinema's website.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
So there's a website into the show.
And I will put a link up to the JB Hi-Fi site, because this thing is like $6.98. It's a low-budget release. It's nothing. It was ever going to be a full price.
And if you have a player that can play it, you know.
Yeah. It's, like I said, it's a full-frame effort, but it's better than nothing for the moment.
Well, I'm finding the Umbrella release is very region-friendly. Like my Slaughter in San Francisco Umbrella DVD played fine on my upstairs Blu-ray that doesn't like to play anything foreign or...
I don't think Umbrella... Domestic. Yeah, from memory, Umbrella don't code their titles, whether it be DVD or Blu-ray, because it's basically run by fans as well, you know, who are film fans.
They know there's a big market in export, so I don't think they're fools about that. Like, their Man from Hong Kong super release is available on American Amazon. It's like and not as an import. Like, Amazon carries some of their titles. Yeah, just carries them.
That is loaded, that damn Blu-ray. I haven't got it yet.
I need to get it.
It's got Man from Hong Kong, a bunch of extras, and 5 more Trenchard Smith films on there in standard def.
Yeah.
That's insane. Like
it's a Trenchard box set, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. So when JB's got that thing for like 20, 15, 20 bucks on a sale, I'll go grab it and pick it up. And I think I told you, John, I was at the Umbrella office a number of months back, and I just had like piles and piles of Man from Hong Kong on Blu-ray right next to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Pretty cool. Cool place. I might actually ring up Umbrella, and this is going to sound sad now. I'm going to make Hunter laugh, most likely. I'm going to ring them up and see if I can get if they got some sort of widescreen print of Red Rider. Yeah, so that's that.
All right, guys. Well, I just want to remind you all to go to midnightmoviecowboys.com if you want to help support the show. If you want to help us get us better equipment, help us get us – great grammar there, dude. Go click the PayPal button. Donate what you can. If you can't donate, go to iTunes, rate and review us. That would be very helpful. And also, what am I forgetting?
You're forgetting one thing. One thing.
What? What's that?
When are you coming back, Red Rider?
Yeah.
No, that's not the answer. When are you coming back, Red Rider?
I don't know.
No, it's I don't know.
I don't know.
Actually, no, it's never.
Never.
I ain't never coming back. I know that film verbatim. It's sad. I know every fucking line from that movie just about.
So, yeah, but subscribe on iTunes. Let's know some Stitcher, all that good stuff. So, do you have anything to add, Stu?
No, glad we finally got to talk about this. I'm sorry I didn't go in depth. Had I done that, this probably would have been about another 2 hours longer, and you don't want to ruin everything for you, because I probably would go line for line for line from this film. And
we'd have to call it when you're coming back straight, man.
No, more like when's this fucking episode going to finish is what it'd be called.
Yeah, when's this going to end?
Yeah, when's this episode going to ever end? Yeah, when you coming back, Australia, man. That should be the name of the show, you know?
When you coming back, Australia, man. Let's go ahead and wrap it up. John, do you have anything to add? Anything to plug?
Not this week.
I am trying desperately to find my Adam and the Ants Kings of the World Frontier Super Deluxe Edition. And not have any luck. Become more and more expensive as the days go by. But just saying.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and say adios.
And I'll say Megadog Mahalo.
There's a war on for your mind.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.